to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. It's a beautiful day here. I hope it is where you are as well.
Beautiful day in the neighborhood. A beautiful day.
Yeah, right. Oh, man. I just, gosh.
I know. We're actually very lucky because we're having like late September weather and it's late August. So
Yeah, I know.
But I just got back from Austin where I spend about a third of my time and it was hotter than blazes down there. And I have a feeling it's very hot where our guest is today, but we will find that out in a minute. Would you like to introduce Steve?
Yes, I would. Yeah. Steve O'Keefe is an author, editor, and book industry professional who has helped hundreds of writers go from brainstorm to bestseller. He has worked with prison writers, Pulitzer Prize writers, college students, adult writing programs, and hundreds of successful authors in both fiction and nonfiction. And he has written a book that is, if you're just wondering how to get started, this is the book. And it's Set the Page on Fire, Secrets of Successful Writers, by Steve O'Keefe. And welcome to Writers' Voices, Steve.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction, Carolyn. Thank you, Monica, for having me here today. And it's remarkably comfortable here today in Virginia, where I am, up in the Shenandoah Valley.
Oh, I thought you were in New Orleans based on your book. So that's...
Yeah, the hurricanes chased me out of there. About 10 years ago, I moved up to this nice, safe spot in the Shenandoah Valley in Stanton, Virginia, and I just love it here. So.
Is it a mountainous region?
Yeah, it is. It's nothing like New Orleans. And I lived in New Orleans for 15 years, and I finally had had it with, I was a business owner, and six of the people that worked with me got washed out during Katrina. And they lost all their homes and their possessions, and everybody was on the road for a couple of years. And but we all got together, and we decided we liked being on the road. So that became the new business plan.
So you all work remotely now?
That's right.
Wow.
And I still work with a lot of people in New Orleans. Most of my team is still down there.
Now, what is your business? I know it's book-related.
Bora Bora is the company I own, and that's O-R-O-B-O-R-A, and it just doesn't really mean anything as a word. But for us, it's an online marketing firm that uses professional writers to create blogs, white papers, and newsletters, other documents for businesses and for nonprofits. So one of our customers is House the Homeless in Texas, which is in Austin, Texas. You mentioned Austin. They've been a client of ours for 10 years now, probably, and we produce their two posts a week, their blog and a monthly newsletter. And the writer that we hire on that account is in Colorado. So, I've hired writers from all over the world to produce blogs and other work for clients. And so some of those tips are in here, and I think one of the things that it shows for people who write English is a lot of our writers are not, English is not their first language. And it isn't important to us that they be grammatically correct. What's important for us in most cases is that they do the research and that the work is original. So this is a lesson for some writers out there. Don't worry too much about the polish, because all publishers have, you know, editors and copy editors, proofreaders, and we all know how to use spell checkers now. So it's really not as important that your writing be that meticulous as it is that it has this strong voice. And I think voice is something that people can't put into the writing. You know, an editor can't give it that voice, but they can fix the mistakes. So don't sweat the mistakes and try to make sure that your voice gets in there.
Now, that's one of your top 10 secrets of successful writers, that mechanics don't matter. But, Mom, as a former English teacher, how does that strike you?
Well, Well, you know, if you're writing a resume or you're trying to get a job, then mechanics do matter. But I'm sure there are times when they don't. And of course, I've write a lot of things, but I've never tried to publish anything. And so when I write, I try to make sure that everything is grammatically correct. But you know, it matters in some parts of the world and some parts of jobs, but it doesn't always matter, I guess, in everything.
Well, I think it matters in the final output. So, for example, you wouldn't want the publisher to leave the typos in.
Right.
But there are
right.
some examples right. in the books of people who had 30 mistakes per paragraph, you know, it's some sort of a world record. And yet they got in, they were published because of the content of the message. So that's what I'm saying is focus on that content. And if you want to be fussy about your writing, then yes, save it for the cover letters and the pitch letters that you're using to get people interested in the writing.
Right.
Like if somebody were to apply for a job as a writer, it does look bad to have a bunch of typos in your resume. But on the work that writers turn in that we then edit for customers, we really don't care about anything except that it gets in on time and that it's accurate. So the style and everything is something we'll probably add to it. So,
okay, but given if you have one writer who has, it's accurate, it's on time, it has a voice, and it's fairly correct versus one that's not, is there a preference?
to some degree, why I like what I would call wild. Well, let me give you an example. I wrote a book on internet publicity for John Wiley and Sons, a textbook for the publisher. And the first six chapters took 6 months, and the last six chapters took 6 weeks. So I was obviously writing so much faster on the end of it to hit a manuscript due date. And at that point, I wasn't paying any attention to mechanics. I was just trying to get the darn job done and out the door. And what I found in my own writing, and this is true in the writing of dozens of authors who I've edited as a book editor for a publisher, is that the faster writing was actually had a stronger voice. It did suffer for mechanics, and those did have to be fixed, but it had this very strong sense of continuity that ran through those chapters from being done very quickly. So sometimes when we polish our writing too much, we take out that personality and that voice that makes it ours. Like you can imagine someone like James Joyce going to a copy editor. They would have thought he was a maniac. So, and yet there is this voice that comes through that defeats, lack of grammar, that lack of form. And I think that's true for writers. We have this voice, and it comes out when we write quickly. And part of the reason it comes out then is because we take this shift from a verbal vocabulary of about 10,000 words, which is what the average high school graduate in the U.S. has a spoken vocabulary of 10,000 words and a written vocabulary of 40,000 words. So once you start writing and you make that shift in your head from talking to actually writing, the words come out faster and you have a much bigger toolkit to express yourself with. And the result is writing that's easier for the reader to understand.
Okay.
Now we have interviewed hundreds of authors over the past, we're going on 13 years of doing this show. And we find that there are quite a few who do ascribe to that method of writing where they write everything quickly for the first draft. But then most of them go back and rework it often 2, 3, 4, 5 times and polish it. But then there's a whole other camp that likes to start out the day by polishing what they had written the day before they move on. And there's some that edit as they go. And these are all successful published writers. So would you say that, you know, maybe what works for one doesn't necessarily work for another?
Oh, well, of course, everybody has their own method. But I think that the quicker that you move to your written vocabulary and out of your verbal vocabulary, the more you start piling up the work as a writer. So we're talking about generating a lot of output. You have to look for that shift in yourself at the keyboard where you start flying. And I do think that the writing of everyone is improved when they reach that flow state where the words are coming just as fast as you can possibly get the keys on the keyboard to move. And then from that flow state, some people edit lightly and some people edit not at all. But if you don't get to that flow state, you never get that quality of writing that is just strong and sweeps the reader along with it. Yeah, it's going to take some polish. Like my own technique is I still write on a manual typewriter because I want to be disconnected from the internet when I'm working on rough draft. So I try to write very quickly on a manual typewriter. Now, I'm not recommending that. That's not one of the top 10 secrets of successful writers. That's just my own method. And once I write it on the typewriter, then I edit by hand, and then I keyboard the edited version in. So I sort of edit while I keyboard and then do a quick spell check, and I'm done. So part of, I think, piling up the writing for the time spent is to disconnect from the internet when you write. And that's one of the top tips is airplane mode, write in airplane mode. And that means you have to turn off the noisy distractions that try to pull you away from writing while you're writing. And that if you do your editing while you're writing, it's going to take forever to get anything done.
I think that's true. And also, it's so much more fun to write when you're in the flow, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, and that's the little present for those who reach that state is it's just addictive. So,
yeah.
I joke with my publisher that you get this surge of the hormone alpha-betamine that just gets you going at the typewriter.
Now, we've interviewed some writers who still do first drafts by hand. There's been some, I think, some research about how the connection from, you know, the brain to the pen and that how good that is for your brain to actually handwrite things. But, of course, it's much slower to do it that way. The advantage, and well, you talk about this in your book, too, is you can do it anywhere.
Absolutely. And like you, I've interviewed hundreds of authors. I had a business for 4 years called Author Views, running around the country interviewing authors about their books to create video trailers. And you're right. I was surprised by how many of them still write longhand on pads and stuff. And that rate is that usually about 20 words a minute for the average person when you're writing longhand. So it takes longer, but even a full-length manuscript of 80,000 words, you can do that in 1 month if you write it longhand. So it's not... these aren't, 20 words a minute is still a huge clip. If you can achieve that on a regular basis, then you can write a book in a fairly short order. And typing is about 40 words a minute. The fastest way of writing a book is to dictate it. And we speak at about 140 words a minute. But the problem is not many of them are very good words. Our verbal vocabulary is only 10,000 words. So when you look at transcripts on YouTube or a transcript of this call, and then you'll see that we use baby talk language when it comes out in writing in a transcript. And so you have to be aware when you are writing by voice that you have to dig deeper in your vocabulary. And some of the people who do very well with voice dictation are the visually impaired. So they are quite meticulous about what they say when they know they're being recorded. And so their paragraphs come out more needing less editing. But really the fastest way to write would be to dictate and then clean up the dictation.
Well, Steve, when I started reading your book and one of the first things you talk about is this difference between the spoken vocabulary and the written vocabulary, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But it made me think about the autobiography of Mark Twain that came out. You know, he had a thing that it wasn't to be published until 100 years after his death. So it was published a few years ago. And really love Mark Twain. And I bought that, I think, on Kindle. And I read quite a bit of it, but I never really got absorbed with it. And Mark Twain's one of my favorite writers. But he dictated that. He didn't write down himself. At least most of it was dictated in his later years. And it just made me think, even someone who, I mean, he was an amazing public speaker, so you would think that his spoken vocabulary would be great.
Yeah, about the only time that that those transcripts of written presentations have the kind of depth that natural writing has is when people are just reading from a written script. And it shows the value of using a written script whenever you're doing public speaking, because you will reach a much deeper level of description and explanation working from a written script.
And also a much clearer flow of ideas.
Yeah.
Usually.
You have time to practice.
Yeah. And you don't go off on tangents that lead nowhere, and then you have to figure out how to get back to the actual topic.
Yeah.
Well, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Steve O'Keefe, author of Set the Page on Fire, Secrets of Successful Writers. So, Mom, I know, you know, you underlined a lot in this book. So, what were some of the things that really grabbed you?
Well, I wanted him to explain this, explain the four-part pitch. That was, it sounded intriguing to me.
And I have to say, in presentations that I've been doing since the book came out, the four-part pitch is what people want to talk about most. And it's no surprise, this book started 25 years ago when I was, I had been a book editor for 10 years, and I thought I knew all about it. And I'd worked with a lot of different writers, and I was teaching a class for adult writers in Port Townsend, Washington at the time. And I added a second class on how to get published, and that class was standing room only, and the other writing class not so much. So the thing is, people, they're less interested in learning how to write than how to find outlets for the writing that they're doing. And so a good portion of this book is devoted to that, and it revolves around using this four-part pitch. And the pitches are, it's a simple pitch that's been honed with literally millions of repetitions. And it starts with a stroke, or pay the receiver a compliment. The second part is the pitch, state your case. And the third part is your credentials paragraph, why you. And the fourth part is action alternatives, which means you don't want to back people into a yes or no position. You want to offer some third route for them. And so how this works for writers, this can be used for a lot of different things, like finding a job. But specifically for writers, most people querying or sending a pitch letter, that used to be called queries, now they call them pitches. But when you pitch, you're trying to get in front of an editor, and that isn't somebody to correct your work. That's somebody to purchase it. And at a publisher, they call them acquisitions editor. So the name editor implies that they are writing mechanics, but the fact is that some editors don't deal with the mechanics. They just purchase. And that's an acquisitions editor for a book publisher, or just an editor for a newspaper or magazine. And, so the first line of your pitch to them better be about how wonderful they are, because if it's not, they're not going to go to line two. And if you have that in there, if you have a genuine compliment in your opening line of your letter, it's almost guaranteed that they're going to read your pitch, which is the second paragraph. And if they read that and they like it, they're going to look at your credentials And then you're going to offer them a couple of different ways that you'd like them to respond. You don't send a sample with your writing. You don't send an outline. You don't send anything more than these four paragraphs. And in some cases, they can be trimmed and combined into almost a single tweet or text message. Compliment, state your case, why you, and then what you want, what actions you would like them to take. And so for a compliment for a publisher or an editor, you have to pay them a compliment on a number of books that they edited, or pay them a compliment on an article that they ran, or something that they did that you noticed that connects with your book. And so after working at a publisher for over a decade, I would say about 90% of the pitch letters we received didn't have the name of anyone at the publishing company on them. They weren't addressed to any specific person. They were just to the publisher or to the company. So really, just by putting the person's name on the pitch, you stand out from 90% of the other pitches that they receive, that you at least know their name. And then when you pay them a compliment, you really ascend yourself into the top 2% of people that they hear from, people who know who they are, know what they do, and think that their work fits. And so that's what this pitch letter is about. You really want the publisher to ask you then for the sample, to ask you for the article. You don't want to include it. You want that pitch. And when you get to the action alternatives, the main alternative that you want is you have a line like this. If this project isn't right for you at this time, can you refer me to someone who you think might be interested? And so you always want a referral. That referral is maybe more important than the initial response. Because, you don't know when your letter hits, the person's life may have changed. They may be editing children's books now, and they're no longer editing adult sci-fi or, whatever is going on in their life, you're not aware. But when they refer you to somebody, then they're thinking this might fit with so-and-so. And then that becomes the stroke of your next pitch. I was referred to you by Mr. Big Shot author, and you're on your way. And these referrals are, if you tumble this four-part pitch, it's going to lead to your publication. And it's certainly going to lead to publishers asking to see your work instead of you always pushing, to begging them to look at it. They'll be begging you to send it in.
Boy, there's a lot to this, isn't there? Golly.
Well, so many people, my wife is a collage artist, and she started as a writer, and she wrote a novel that she tried for a couple of years to get published. And she went to New York, and she met with agents, and the project never went anywhere. And it never occurred to her to look up the editors that she was pitching and find out what other books they edited and see if there was a connection there. And so I have a new author I'm just working with now. And that's Sandy Rosenthal at Levies.org down in New Orleans. And she's got a heck of a book that's ready to go, queued up and ready to go. And she just gave me a list of books that she thinks are either similar or that she has respect for that are in the same field. And then I went and found out who the agents were on those books and who the editors were on those books. And sure enough, one of the editors is someone she knows, and we're off and running now.
And how do you go about finding out who the agents and editors are?
Well, this is going to sound remarkably simple, but you can go to an online bookstore of your choosing that has a look inside the book feature. And many books now have look inside the book, and you just search look inside the book for agent, or you search for editor. And usually author will thank their agent and their editor somewhere in the acknowledgement in the book. And you can go into a bookstore. You can come out with the names of 10 agents and editors after maybe 1 hour in a bookstore flipping through acknowledgement. and then you go home and look them up on the internet and see what else they've done. And once you start getting to know these agents and these editors, which is the layer right behind the authors, then you're traversing the right path to get published, because those folks are going to either publish you or refer you to somebody if your stuff actually fits with the stuff that they've worked on before. They usually want more of what made them successful. So rare is the editor or the agent that wants to now, you know, leave a field like, say, mathematics books or something, and then go into, animal veterinarian books. I mean, people stay in the same field and they want more of whatever made them successful. So if your book is similar to another, now, with Sandy Rosenthal in New Orleans, she bears her story is similar to Aaron Brockovich. And so we're looking at two published books on Aaron Brockovich, and we're finding those editors and agents, and then pitching those people because they're going to want another hit. And Aaron Brockovich was a hit for them. So.
Okay. So initially it's targeting your pitch to the right person, finding the...
That's it.
Yeah.
It's not a shotgun approach of sending 100 out.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's the right individual person at the right company.
That's right.
And
you're
addressing
for the editor or the agent. Yep. Right,
and addressing them directly. And then you move on to your pitch. What's your top advice about the pitch paragraph itself?
That you have to keep it to one paragraph. You have to explain your book or your project in one paragraph. Sometimes when I'm doing articles, I'll actually pitch three. I'll write to the editor, say something really beautiful about the last story I read of theirs. And then I'll say, you know, would you be interested in one of these three stories? And I'll have a headline and a subhead for each three, and then my credentials and my action alternative. So you can even pitch more than one, but you don't include them. You just you only write the ones that they say yes to, and that's secret number two out of the top 10 is get a commitment in writing. So that writing can just be email or a text. It can be, yeah, go ahead, do it. It doesn't mean you're going to get paid, but it means that they want to see the writing. And when you get that commitment, like when I do that where I pitch three stories at once, I only write the ones that they want. So the other two don't get written unless somebody else types up or I put them in later.
Now, credentials... That's easy for you. You have a lot of writing credentials. What about somebody who's just getting started, or like someone who's written a novel, they're a first-time author? How do they pitch their credentials?
And that's a good question. It's a tough situation. And there is a situation similar to that in the book with the author Maggie Thrash, who is now a very popular young adult author. And she started when she asked for my help, and we developed a four-part pitch, but she had no writing credentials. And so writing credentials is a tough paragraph. And I believe that if you know how to write, then you deserve to have your writing considered by an editor or agent. So you have to get through this paragraph of why you or what are your credentials as a writer. So you can look for things such as, if you've written a letter to the editor, then your writing has appeared in the name of the publication. If you have written anything that was published in junior high school or high school, in a newsletter, in a yearbook, any of those count as publications, and you can dress those up pretty well. And here's an example of an easy one that people can do. There's an exercise in the book called What Does Your Moon Look Like? And it's to send me 50 words about the moon, and I put them on the web. And the idea is that if we go as long as 50 words, no two persons' descriptions of the moon will ever duplicate. So you're talking about billions of possible descriptions of the moon, which is the same thing for all of us. I mean, it's the same moon. And there's 20 billion different ways of looking at it. And so this exercise is a lot of fun. And anyone can send it to me at steve-o'keefe.com. And I'm steve-o'keefe at steve-o'keefe.com. And you send me your 50-word description of the moon, and I will publish it on my site. And then you can say that you've been published on one of the top websites for writers on the Internet. So there's an easy way to get a credit.
That's great. That's great.
All right.
I never even thought about, you know, I have lots of what I've written published on the Internet. I mean, my Writer's Voices website has tons of stuff that I wrote. And I never would have even thought about trying to dress that up as a writing credential.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
Oh, yes, it is. That's even a legitimate one.
Yeah.
So Maggie Thrash, the woman whose story is told in the book, she didn't have even that. So what she came up with her credentials paragraph was that she was in a writing program and that she was a tutor in a writing workshop. So neither of those are writing credits. You'll notice that's not anything appearing in print. That's classes. But with this pitch, she pitched an editor at Sassy Magazine. The editor sent her work to an editor at Random House. As soon as Random House was looking at it, she was able to get an agent. She got one of the top literary agents in the country, and then she finally did get published by Simon & Schuster. And, you know, it did take a while. There's a timeline in there with her story, and it didn't happen overnight, but now she has some eight books to her name, and she's a well-regarded and up-and-coming, young adult author. So, and that all started with this four-part pitch and zero writing credentials.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Steve O'Keefe, author of Set the Page on Fire, Secrets of Successful Writers. Now, in here, you talk about really how anybody can be a writer. And, Mom, I know that you've had a writing group at your church where you've also encouraged and said that anybody can be a writer.
Well, it's just like talking. You just put it down on paper.
And
I think that's what it's like.
Yes. What are
but a
your...
lot of people are
yeah.
you know, people are afraid to write. Someone told them at one time that they couldn't write, whether it's a teacher or I don't you know, but that their writing wasn't good. So then they never try it again. But I try to encourage them with I use that. Oh, I think a clustering where you start with your main theme and then you put down stuff, you know, draw lines and draw circles and so, and put in ideas. So when you start to write, you won't forget them because when you're writing, say, okay, the most recent one I had was I wanted these ladies, it was a widow's group. I wanted them to write for their children how they and their spouse met. And because I said that's something I never knew that my parents and I wish I had, I certainly wish I had. And so, you know, that's something that they can pass on. And that to me, writing is very important to pass on to your children or your family. And so I don't know, a lot of them didn't seem to take to it, but they didn't want to start writing. They didn't want to start writing as there, but I hope when they got home that they took that idea and tried it because, you know.
So, Steve, you have a whole chapter on You Can Do This, which is, you know, geared to encouraging really everybody to write.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason people get intimidated is because of that writer's warm-up part, the part before we switch into our written vocabulary. When we're still fumbling around, the first few words that get down on the page and people start writing and it just doesn't come out the way they're thinking it was going to come out in their head. It's the writing, the page looks a little empty. The sentences aren't really grabbing like you thought they would. And that's because until you spend a few minutes at it, you don't make that shift. And you can see how your verbal ideas, when they go onto the page, sound flat. And you have to, you have no inflection. Like here I'm using all kinds of tricks with my voice to convey meaning. And people do it with pacing and with humor and with tone and with eye contact and hand gestures. And all of these things are gone when you start writing. And you have to find a way to reattach those feelings with alphabet. You know, you have to find a way to recreate those gestures and those changes in tone and everything that involves successful communication. You only have letters to work with, letters and a few punctuation points. So it takes a little while. And that's what I would say to a beginner writer. You know, everybody sounds crummy the first couple of minutes with the typewriter or the keyboard, whatever. If you stay at it a little bit and then go back, yes, I agree that editing your work is a good thing. So I'm not an anti-editing, but I'm anti-editing while you're writing. And so you got to get your momentum up, and then you'll see how big your toolkit is. Once you get flying at the keyboard and the words are coming and you realize you can create whole worlds and universes out of your own mind and have them come out on the page, it's magic. So I would say you got to hang in there. It takes a little bit of time, and hang in there. And if you don't take to it, you know, some people don't take to it, but it's not because you don't have an ability for this. We can all do it. And one way, I work with a lot of students at the Virginia School for the Deaf and Blind. I'm an assistive technology coach there in my spare time. And these students are writing, in some cases they're blind, and in some cases they're deaf. And so what they want to do is they like to review. So reviewing is an easy way to get new writers into the process. I want you to review this book. I want you to review a device. I want you to review your phone, review a song, review a toy. And when they start, because there's a desire to have their opinions count. And when you review, many of these students think about their opinions going up on YouTube or on Amazon next to these products, what they think about it. And they really get off on it. That's a great motivator to get the writing done, is a desire to have what I think about this product put online, my opinion. And so reviewing is an easy way in, plus it leads to good writing skills, in that if you review something, you have to say sort of what it is, you know, and then what you like about it and why you like it. So it leads to asking the kinds of questions that one would ask in an interview, for example.
You know, one of the great takeaways from this book for me was this thing about scheduling time at the keyboard. And it's in, you know, in the summary, it says 2 hours a day equals a book in a month. 1 hour a day equals a book in 2 months. 15 minutes a day equals a book never, because it takes 15 minutes to get warmed up. Now, you also give some hints on how to shorten that warm up time. Could you share a little bit of that with us?
Yeah, the main thing is, if you write every day, even just a little bit, it tends to keep the muse close, as I say. You want your muse within hearing distance of the keyboard. And you do that by calling the muse on a regular basis. And you can do that by even challenging yourself to make ordinary writing that you do during the day extraordinary, such as phone messages, grocery lists. These things can actually be written with some eloquence, and it's entertaining to do it that way. Even we talk about bring your muse to work day, yeah. And you know, trying to write an email like you were a different style, you know, and so I think that when you write small things, that is one way the when you're writing regularly, it may only take you 5 minutes to just wrap right into your writing brain, your writing vocabulary, and then you're off. And with regular writers, it's like that all the time. With newspaper writers, they're used to this, and they often lop off the first two paragraphs and start the story there, because they know that the beginning's always finding their place. And then once they have their place, they can just drop that beginning off, and the rest of the story just goes. Another a tool I use is something called Poopensprachen. And Poopensprachen, it's a writing game. And this game is to make up a word at the beginning of your writing session. So say you got from 5 to 7, you're going to be writing. And so at 5, you know, you go into Poopensprachen, which is just to make up a new word that describes your situation at the moment. There's no real particular set of commands. So if you're happy but cold, it might be, chili chap. I'm just making weird stuff up. So you make up these weird words, and they often sound German, like you're piling one word into another, which is just the Poopensprachen element of it. And what it does is it forces you out of that verbal vocabulary, and it forces you to reach down into the written vocabulary, and just doing that once is enough. And I, you know, I created a lot of words that way that I used to try to get onto. Stephen Colbert had a segment called Word of the Day or Word on his show, and I sent him words like spindividualist that came from a session like that. And I could never get on his show, I had no bear was one of my words, which is the inability to get on Colbert. So,
and did he take that one?
No, he hasn't taken anything yet. But he does have a copy of the book, so that's nice.
Oh, wonderful.
And so anytime there's listening exercises, they're also mentioned in the book, and that is an exercise where you just say, write down everything you can hear right now. And you just try to get still for a second and listen to everything, all the ambient noise, and describe it all. And it takes about, 3 minutes of doing that is enough. And immediately you're into your written vocabulary. And partly that's because anytime you have to describe a sound, anytime you have to describe a taste or a flavor or something that is not already verbal, you're forced to come up with words. And like if you tried to say, what does vanilla taste like? Well, we could be here for a half hour trying to figure out some way of saying what vanilla tastes like, but just the effort to attempt that a little bit is enough to just light that vocabulary on fire. You set the page on fire, and then you just take off.
Wow. So. Steve, why don't you read a little bit from Set the Page on Fire?
Okay. Set the page.
And this is definitely a book that you could pick up it and read any chapter on its own, and you'd get something out of it without even having read the other chapters.
Right.
And let's see, I have my chapters list here.
Okay. And then once we do that, I want to talk a little bit about your thoughts about getting published.
Okay. And let's see, you have interviewed a lot of writers. Let me talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about dark side. Is that all right? Can I go there?
Yeah.
This is chapter 4 in the book. It's called Thinking, Talking, Writing, Reading. And it discusses what is the difference between when speaking, writing, reading, and thinking. And these are all 4 streams of vocabulary, but they're very different, and because they're different, they cause a lot of confusion. We tend to think of talking as writing, and it's not. And this is a section called Writing from the Dark, Cultivating Your Dark Side.
Okay.
I hope I can get through this, because there's some sections of the book I can't even read anymore. They're too evoke too many feelings for me. Okay, one reason would-be writers have trouble rendering their ideas into words is they're afraid of what they will uncover. I was not prepared for this when I started teaching. My goal was just to get people writing. I believe the answers to all questions about writing could be found by writing. You can talk and illustrate all you want, but no one will ever understand the writing process by trying to think it through. What I learned from teaching is that when people start writing, it doesn't take them very long to start writing about trauma. Powerful writing is often distilled from powerful experiences. For better or worse, we tend to remember our hurts much more keenly than our pleasures. It doesn't take long in life to get hurt, and badly. Our culture doesn't encourage talking about those hurts, unless it's on daytime television or with a professional therapist. When you combine a desire to write with serious pain that has gone unacknowledged or undiscussed, once you set the page on fire, you will find yourself opening old wounds and examining them. I think a lot of potential writers realize this, and pain drives some people away from writing for fear of what they might find. Good writing comes from the clarity and intensity of the feelings we have about our trauma. It can be heartbreaking to read the prose of a mother whose child's out, or a soldier who had no choice but to kill an enemy combatant, or who did have a choice and chose to kill. These are difficult events to live with. They can be difficult to write about, too. However, once you set the page on fire, you'll see memories pour out of you with fullness and detail you might never have experienced just thinking about them. Writing gets you to remember in ways that thinking does not. The writing mind can be quite detailed about things the thinking mind leaves vague and ill-defined. I'm not a counselor, but I suspect this outpouring of old hurts is probably a good thing. Perhaps it enables writers to put their pain into context, or just put it in the past, something that happened, not something they're still going through. It might be that the only reason you're interested in writing is to get these episodes onto the page in hopes of gaining greater sense of understanding or inner peace. Once you've written your way through them, it's possible that you will have gotten what you needed from the writing process. A desire to deal adequately with tragedy is the motivating force behind about a quarter of the hundreds of writers I've interviewed. Now, I wonder if that's true for you.
Probably,
I'm taking a digression
here
from the text to ask whether you find that many of your writers are really just exploring some tragic thing that happened to them.
Well, there definitely are some.
Would you say you find that quite often?
Quite often.
This is a question, not from the book.
Yeah, I know.
In my writers group, see, what I tried to get them to do was remember their past, like the name of I named it Remembering Ourselves, and things that happened to us when we were children, because most of us are in our 70s and 80s, and so, you know, it's kind of neat to go back and remember things that were happy times and not so happy times, or things that, you know, I don't know, I enjoyed that, I really did. And some of my people in there really did too. They got into it.
We definitely have a lot of writers who are writing from some sort of trauma, particularly the memoirists, because, you know, as we all, like you say, it's tragedy is more interesting than, you know, a nice pleasant life. In fact, someone just said yesterday that, you know, there's no, I think it was the author we interviewed yesterday, a perfect relationship is boring. You know, there's got to be some conflict.
I'll continue to read from the section.
Yes.
It has something about an interview that you might appreciate in here.
Okay.
So a desire to deal adequately with tragedy is the motivating force behind a quarter of the hundreds of writers I've interviewed. It's difficult to talk about hard things. It's easier to write about them. Writers say it takes only a few lines of type to return them to the time and the place of their tragedy. That's the power of this thing we call alphabet. When When I interviewed famous vampire novelist Poppy Zebright, I couldn't get a smile out of it, something I needed from every interview to the still image that we anchor the video to. I asked about his agent. Bad idea. I switched to his publisher. No kind words. Finally, we started talking about restaurants in New Orleans, and he said the book gave him a chance to settle scores with all the bad places to eat in town. He smiled a devilish smile, the shot I needed, and went on to describe with great joy how much these restaurants fail. Writing from the dark side can lead to captivating prose because both writers and readers enjoy seeing justice prevail. No amount of interviewing prepared me for the half hour I spent with Joel Agee, son of the famous author James Agee. Joel's father died at the young age of 45 on his way to the hospital. At the time, Joel was a child living in Berlin with his mother and his half-brother, Stefan. The following year, Joel's father posthumously won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for A Death in the Family, a novel based on the death of his own father, Joel's grandfather, in a car crash. Years later, Stefan, his half-brother, started slipping into madness. Joel got the idea that if he could reach his brother, he could pull him out of the darkness. Joel used his writing to induce a mental illness similar to his brother's, an illness he almost did not escape from. He was unsuccessful in reaching his brother, who committed suicide. Joel himself was institutionalized and almost lost his own life. The book In the House of My Fear, a memoir, is the incredible story of this dark journey. You can watch my unsettling interview with Joel Agee at the companion website for this book. So once you have dealt with your hurts as much as you feel you need to, you remove blockage to all the other things you'd like to write about. In this sense, writing about the hurts can be a kind of exercise in which you test how good you are at communicating strong feelings in prose. Don't be surprised if you find traumas bubbling up in your writing, even if you don't want to write about them or thought you were done with them. Writing is a process of discovery. Some of the things you discover will not be pleasant. Writer's block may be holding you back for good reason. If you are an honest and persistent writer, you will eventually uncover a dark side to yourself. What are you going to do with it? I think I know what Brenda Yulin would say. She's the author of the book, If You Want to Write. Now we're getting somewhere. Get to know this charming devil. Take him around to the neighbors while you're at it. Great horror fiction comes from looking in the mirror. Do you harbor nefarious desires? You may not be able to write your way around them. Once you find the dark side of your character, it will be difficult for you to write other material without first dealing with these demons. And that's the end of that section.
So thank you, Steve. That was Steve O'Keefe reading from Set the Page on Fire, Secrets of Successful Writers. And we definitely have had a few interviews that were writers that were writing from the dark side, particularly memoirs. And, of course, the one that really comes to mind is Sue Klebold, who was the author or the mother of the Columbine shooter and wrote about that.
Yeah,
that took such bravery to write that. But, Steve, before we run out of time, just in the last few minutes, you definitely recommend commercial publishing as opposed to self-publishing. Would you like to?
Yeah, I think that unless we're talking about family stories, and Carolyn mentioned with her writing group that she's trying to encourage them to write their family stories, and I would just add a voice to that that's saying that writing is one of the best tools that we have for understanding our lives and the world around us, and that when we write about these things, oftentimes we come to see the point of our life in a different perspective. So writing helps us suss that out, even if it doesn't go any further than our drawers, you know. But for the reason I don't like self-publishing that much is because I feel like you need to have at least 500 copies of a book out there if you're going to get any kind of momentum in terms of sales. So many publishers that I work for routinely give away 500 to 1,000 copies of a book that is a new book, review copy. And some, like the best of them, Sourcebooks, for example, will give out 3,000 to 5,000 copies of a new book, free copies as review copies, to generate the kind of buzz that they need to get a national sales movement started. And so when you self-publish, if you really want to be commercially successful, you have to print a bunch of review copies. And if you do that, it costs you so much to print them when you go through typical self-publishing routes that you might as well either bite the bullet and print like 2,000 of them, which makes you a commercial publisher, or go to a commercial publisher and get published. Mm-hmm. And so it's because if you're going to do something that's as big as important as a book and you want it to reach more than just your family members, you really have to give away hundreds, if not thousands, of copies. And that's expensive. And it's better if you can get a publisher to do that. So
yeah,
I think if people try the technique, the four-part pitch in the book, they'll never go back to any other way of pitching again, because it is very effective at getting a commercial publisher for your interest in your work. And that's because even if you have the wrong person, they usually refer you to the right person.
Well, Steve, with all your experience talking to so many writers and working in the publishing world, at what point, if someone's trying to get published and they've been trying for years, at what point would you expect them to be successful or give up? Like, if you've been doing it for 5 years, is it time to give up?
Yeah. Well, from all the writers I've interviewed, I calculated an average of 8 years to get a book commercially published. And it took 8 years of effort on their part, and or it took 8 years for them of being a self-published author to generate enough sales to interest a commercial publisher in picking up the book. So a commercial publication starts with about 10,000 copies, and you have to be able to get rid of 10,000 copies in a short period of time when you are commercially published. So it does take about 8 years, but literally 100% of the authors I've interviewed were happy that they did this. Mm-hmm. Not one of them felt like it was overall, all in all, a bad experience. And the majority, I would say more than half, want to write another book, whether self-published or commercially published. Wow. So that shows that there's really a high level of satisfaction for authors, even if it takes freaking forever to get that book out. and it does. It just does. It takes way longer than it should, and it's so difficult, frustrating. And when you're self-published, you're like, there's all these sharks out there that are trying to fleece you, and so you have that added pleasure of having to navigate around them. So,
right. Plus, you have to take care of all of the business end of publishing, which not all writers are interested in doing or really have the ability or skill to do.
Yeah, unless you want to be an entrepreneur, I would suggest trying to just be a writer and try and spending and working hard to find a publisher the way I recommend, which is to zero in on a specific editor or agent, find out what was successful for them, and then mercilessly flatter them until they ask to see your work.
Well, Steve, there's so much more we could cover in here. I didn't even get to asking you about your work with publishing inmates, and there's so many more questions, but we're out of time.
Oh, that gives me a chance to come back. I would love to.
That's right. And thank you so much for being here today. And, Mom, do you have a quote for us to close with?
Yeah, I do. It's, when facing a difficult task, act as though it is impossible to fail. For instance, if you're going after Moby Dick, take along the tartar sauce.
I like it.
Thanks, and goodbye, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye, everyone.